Hey everybody, this is Logan Olson.
This is Ben Jaylee.
And here's our guest,
Bei Yang.
And this is To the Fucking Future. All right, so Bei, what the hell do you do, dude? Give us three different answers. Give us the version you'd be okay with if we say about, if we just talk about dirty things for the rest of the time. Give us the medium version, and then give us the detailed version if we only talk about very high-minded concepts for the next hour.
Well, probably I won't be able to say that I'm from an actual company, but I'll be able to tell you what I do.
Let's do that one.
Okay. So I work in theme park design for one of the largest theme park design firms in the world.
We'll let you figure out who that might be.
And what do you actually – like what would you say is your expertise?
My expertise is probably in computer graphics and selling computer graphics.
Selling computer graphics. What, maybe I'm mishearing the word. Selling as in you actually get – you're like a salesman for computer graphics.
No, as in I am a champion for it.
Understood. Okay. That makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
And cool.
And I also, you know, sometimes manage interns and Yahoos such as yourself.
So, full disclosure, I used to be an intern of Bei's 3 years ago?
Yeah, it was 3 years ago.
Wow, time flies. I've known this bro for 3 years now. But we actually met far before that. We met like 5 or 6 years ago, and I think I bought you a burrito.
No, you took me to a place that I bought a burrito.
Did you buy a burrito for me?
No, I didn't.
So we didn't break bread together, is what you're saying?
We broke bread together. We ate together. We just didn't pay for each other's food.
Okay.
Wait. If you didn't buy him a burrito and you didn't – oh, you bought your own burrito.
We each individually paid for burritos.
Yes.
Sorry, it felt like a weird like puzzle. That it just, two men went to a burrito hut and neither bought each other burritos.
Right.
Who bought what burrito?
Men A plus men B equals burrito.
So anyways, yes, I've known you for a little bit of time now.
That's true.
Bei and I were also roommates for a brief spell.
Yes, right before I got married, actually. He was my last roommate.
I love that you go through this whole explanation of how you guys know each other and met, and then you're like, oh, and we also lived together for a while.
for like 3 months. Logan, being the genius that he is, decided that he didn't want to pay, you know, rent for a full year. So his lease ran out, and he's like, man, I need some place to stay just for like 3 months before I literally get shipped out on a cruise ship for several other months. So it's like, Bei, I know you're getting married in a few months and moving out of this place. Can I just come crash with you for a while? I'm like, yeah, sure, you know. So he comes in, he moves in, and I didn't realize what he actually meant by crash. He literally just like brought a mattress, brought a door, and brought two sawhorses, and he made a desk out of the two sawhorses and the door.
Okay.
That's
and he's like, dude, this is the best way to make a desk. I learned it from my old college professor.
And it was true, right? That's a pretty sweet way to make a desk.
It's a very cheap way to make a very crappy desk.
And that was a pretty sweet roommate, right? It was like the ultimate brocation for like 3 months.
It was a pretty good brocation. I got to say, you're actually like quite clean for how bro you are.
It's a correlation, not causation.
It's true. And I also offered – so the last person that lived there was unfortunately not the cleanest person ever. And I was like, Logan, I will pay for a maid for you. And he's like, okay. But I want to use the maid at the end of when I move out. And then he just ended up cleaning everything anyways because he was just
– because I'm a cool bro.
He's such a clean
dude.
Such a clean, cool bro.
So I actually still owe him a maid service, whatever that may entail.
Is that a metaphor of some sort?
No, actually, I think it's just hiring actual maids.
Hey, I'm here for my maid service.
Hey there, I'm here for the maid service from my brocation with Bei.
That's right.
So let's get back to display technology, because this is a podcast about the future.
Ostensibly.
So here at minute 10 to 15 to 20, because there's no time or clocks in this room. There's actually no way to tell if it's even day out.
But I have my back to the only window, so literally it's like Plato's cave in here for me.
It's just us.
Yep.
It's just these two assholes.
Whole world.
But Bei, I'm going to say, what's the future of shit going into your eyes? What's the future of displays?
Of shit going into your eyes. Well, number one, I don't recommend it. Shit going into your eyes is unsanitary and probably not the best for your health.
I think I mean in the abstract term. What is the future of me getting visual data in my face?
In your face. So, I mean, we can divide this into the near future and the far future. Where do you want to begin?
Let's start with the near future because that's sooner.
Let's start with the near future. Okay. In the near future, obviously, there's some things that are already on the horizon. Google Glass, for example, pretty amazing. I don't know. I'm sure you guys
for
have
every
heard of
single
it.
Thing that you talk about, explain it like we
Explain it like
don't have the internet.
Explain it like you don't have... Okay, well, that would not be possible because Google Glass itself would not actually be possible without the internet.
Explain it like I'm 70.
Okay.
Explain it like I'm 12.
Explain it
like I'm a 70-year-old and a 12-year-old standing next to each other. So we both have to understand it, both the old person and the young person.
Okay.
But specifically the young person, if you had to choose one. Okay, go. Sorry.
Lollipops and Depends.
Yep. Yes.
Got it. Okay. So in terms of Google Glass, you know, Google Glass is wearable computing. This is something that's been kind of bouncing around academic labs for quite a few decades at this point. And finally, this large company has finally put some industrial designers around it and made it not look super dorky / nerdy. That's a matter of opinion, sure. But this is actually a device that you wear, and it's just out of your field of vision. And basically, you can look up, and there's a little display there. That display connects to your cell phone, and in turn, through your cell phone, connects to the World Wide Web, the internet, the cloud, whatever you want to call it. And from there, it's connected to everything. So now you have this device that's a screen, but it is also a recording device. So it's a recording device that records both audio as well as video, and it can take a picture at any time. And what's crazy about this is now we're going to go into a world in which things are being recorded all of the time. And what does that mean for our behaviors? What does that mean for etiquette? What do you do when you go into the bathroom? What do you do when you go into the bathroom and you say, and you hear click from somebody's camera right now, right? It's the same thing, except for now everybody is going to be recording all of the time.
Well, it's kind of like the term, what's panopticon, if anybody's familiar with that?
Yeah. Well, and actually, there's under the same vibe as the panopticon, there was an article in the BBC World News a year or two ago talking about exactly this, where you had the, you know, we're reaching a point where there will be literally everyone can record everything all the time.
That's right.
And then combined with another technology, which was effectively the emergence of extremely resilient and long-lived and extremely tiny data storage. So,
yes.
You know, different new forms of memory storage that is incredibly dense, and also because of the way it's built, if you just leave it there, it's not going to degrade for hundreds if not thousands of years, depending on like the kinds of materials that are in the labs. And so his whole argument, which I found utterly fascinating as a big fucking dork, was that we are just now living in what will one day be known as the dawn of recorded history, because everything up until now has largely been the purview of people who were there, who witnessed it and told other people about it later. And if there's one thing we've learned in the last 10, 20 years of kind of studying human memory and you know, stuff like eyewitness accounts and people in courtrooms, is that human memory is fucking dog shit, and we add all sorts of weird flavor to it. And the further away we get from an event, literally like minute to minute, the more we just kind of fill in the gaps and like, what the fuck ever.
I love how you just mixed your metaphors of dog shit and flavors.
I'm a king of mixed metaphors. And so what his essential point was, the way we view, you know, the misty dawn of history way, you know, in the Fertile Crescent that we don't really have records of, but we have like this kind of dirty evidence of, you know, plows and scrapings on stone, that, you know, 1,000 years from now, they'll feel much the same way about the last 3,000 years, because they're like, yeah, I mean, we got books and stuff, but people just like remembered that shit and then wrote it down. Whereas the things that happen after it, we literally have 857 unique point of view recordings of one event.
So, Bay, how do you feel about that?
No, it's totally true. I mean, but the main thing that I would kind of like to talk about is, what does that mean actually in terms of the long run, right? We talk about recorded history right now, but in terms of how fast we change, in terms of how we look at the data, I think that's kind of the drastic change. Yes, we can make tons and tons of data right now. Everybody's got cell phones, everybody's got video recordings, you know, there's just data flying everywhere right now, but there's still not a very good way to catalog it nor search it. So in terms of what you mean by recorded history, yes, we're dumping a lot of data, but I actually don't think that we will get to a point where it becomes useful until we get to a point where we can actually process, catalog, and identify what all of that stuff is.
Sure. No, I think that's a really excellent point. I think from the perspective of the historian that was writing about these things, it's a matter of taking the subjectivity out of events. that are previously just recorded from a handful of sources,
sure,
and their opinions of those things that happened, sometimes recorded decades after the fact.
Now, I also very much agree with this historian, as well as perhaps this is also your point of view. But the one devil's advocate that I've also heard about this point is the fact that, yes, we are recording so much stuff, but the rate of change, the rate of change of how we store this data is also changing so fast that the rate of comprehension and the rate of adoption of human beings is actually lower than how fast we can change. So in other words, the possibility of it becoming completely obsolete and lost forever also is getting greater.
To be clear, you're not talking about the comprehension of a person, of data coming into a person. I assume you're talking about the digital archivist dilemma insofar as, like, it's really hard for – this is a probably a kind of a lame example, but it'll get the point really across really quickly. It's very hard for me to play a game on Nintendo right now.
Correct.
So just as it's very hard for me to play a WMV Windows Media File that is like version 1.
Right, or an 8-track.
Right? Sure.
Go and find an 8-track player right now. Or a VHS for that matter.
Yes.
I think the historical analog to that are things like, you know, the Linear B script that we have from ancient Greece and stuff like that, where we have, you know, these huge extant, like, you know, pieces of text and stuff from
what's the Linear B?
Linear B is, I hope I'm not butchering this, but Linear B is an alphabet and a script from a period in Greece that we don't have any direct comparison of the alphabet. It's not ancient Greek the way we think of ancient Greek. It's kind of a lost hunk of time in ancient Greece. And we don't have any so the way that we decode old ancient languages, like the most famous example is the Rosetta Stone, where you had, like, if I'm hopefully not screwing this up, but you had, like, hieroglyphics, and then you had Coptic, and then you had Greek, and it was the same – it was the exact same chunk of text repeated three times in Greek, Coptic, and hieroglyphics. And it took a really long time, but with that, we finally figured out what in the hell hieroglyphics were saying by comparing it to the exact same chunk of script. The trick is that with, like, really, really old fragments of language where we have no direct line or direct fragments to compare them against, we have nowhere to start. And in really old script, we're not even exactly sure what symbols are standalone symbols and what aren't. And in some cases, we don't even know if they're if they're like pictographic symbols, like in the sense of like modern Chinese, or if they're more or if they're like phonetic, you know, symbols where we build words out of, like, you know, little phonetic bits in English. And so with these old ancient scripts, like, we just don't know. And we can't even really do a good job of decoding them, even with, like, modern decryption and stuff, because we just don't know enough about them.
That's I find that incredibly surprising, because I literally just wrote down, I would assume because of cryptographic techniques improving over the last 50 years dramatically, specifically, you know, applied mathematics, cryptographic techniques, that we would actually be very very good at figuring out dead languages or figuring out how an alphabet worked.
I mean, you can to an extent. Like, you could, like, for instance, if you took an alphabet that you knew, like, if you took, like, the Latin alphabet or whatever, and you made up your own kind of, like, replacement cipher, basically, where you're just like, okay, E is actually D and F is actually A, and you just do, like, kind of that kind of thing. Like, that sort of thing you can kind of brute force your way through. But when you're talking about an alphabet where you're just literally like, I don't even know what – but they don't even – it's like, is this – okay, is this thing here, is this a symbol? Is it a p noise? Is it a whole word unto itself? Is it punctuation?
Yeah.
Is it a fucking fuck up on the stone?
Linguistics is extremely hard. When you don't have a basis, especially when you don't have a semantic basis, it's basically like you have to just make stuff up.
Yeah. And there are other examples. There, like the script for the Easter Island natives. Like, we have, like, one little scrap of it that is comparative to English, and, like, we don't, you know, we've been, like, maybe one day soon we're going to learn to crack it, and then maybe we'll know more about the, you know, natives of Easter Island and what actually kind of went down there. But until then, we just have a whole bunch of stuff written on, I think it's palm fronds, and we're just like, I don't know what the fuck it is.
That's right. So, I mean, you can imagine the formats being like that, but every 2 years, every yeah, one
exactly.
year, and then every 6 months, and then every 3 months.
Yeah. So we
won't know what the fuck is going on.
We have like 87 petabytes of data that we know it's video of the past, and we have no clue how to access it.
That's right. So, I mean, the probability of that actually happening, I think, is going to get greater and greater.
But I think maybe something that's happened in the – I like this. We're so dramatically off topic right now. The – I feel like in the last 5 years –
about the future? Come on.
It is about the future. No, that's true. I feel like in the last 5 years, the awareness of this – specifically, we actually know a digital historian or a digital archivist or something of that nature. So maybe we'll bring her in.
We should.
Next.
That would be great.
Yeah. She lives in Austin, though.
Do a field trip out to Austin.
There's Google Fiber there.
There is. Soon. One day. You're going to
Right
Austin.
Now. Right now.
Fast internet.
It's already been announced. Google Fiber. Go to Austin.
No. In the future. I, for a second there, I thought you meant they announced they're like, underneath our feet is Google Fiber.
As we speak
and
now.
There's like maybe a comically large switch that they flipped. But anyways, it seems like people are becoming aware of this as a problem. And as codecs change, there will be a increased effort to maintain parity with the past is the wrong term. But,
but it's a really great one.
Well, because it's alliterative.
I know, but like that if you use that phrase, Logan, I swear to God, if you take that phrase and no one else has ever made it before, you need to whore the shit out of that because you'll be famous. It's like Logan Olson, who's best known for coining the phrase parity with the past. And then that's how they introduce you in interviews.
Maybe we
on
should
NPR.
Really quickly.
You
how
can
do we
coin it right now?
Coin it. Coin the fuck out of that thing.
Let's do it as soon as we figure out what does parity mean. What is parity?
I assume it has to do with fruit, right?
Well, you're the one that's using it. Why are you looking at me? You want me to define parity?
I always look at Bay first because Bay thinks he knows everything. So I look at him for maybe like kind of a bullshit answer that I might figure out. What's up, Ben?
By the way, for me, just me over here with my shitty hearing, I know you said Bay, but the way it came out to me was like, babe, you just hang on a minute, babe. And I was like, oh, okay, so that's where this is going.
Okay, the reverse of that is even worse. So when I hang out with people, you know, and their significant others, babe happens to be a very popular, you know, pet name,
yeah.
Right? And they call him that. I'm like, what? Oh, no. You're not telling me that you love me. Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
Good thing Yogan is not a popular pet name or else I would also be going crazy.
Yogan?
I just tried to come up with something that rhymes with Logan.
Okay.
Maybe like Logant?
Logant. There we go. So let's reverse. Let's go back in the Wayback Machine to a few minutes ago when we were talking about the near future display technology. Because everything you've mentioned up to now is really very interesting features of Google Glass, but it's not the actual display itself outside of the fact that it is a transparent overlay on your vision as if you're in Half-Life.
That's right.
So, continue.
So, in terms of Google Glass, now everything is going to be connected, and now you not only have recording, but you also have this display. And this display what they're pitching it as right now is you can video conference, but you can then also have information basically always in your field of view, right? Mm-hmm. So right now in Google Maps, you kind of have to like look at your phone or you have to look at your tablet or whatever. Now it's just instantaneously accessible. So that's kind of Google Glass, and that's not even really the near future. That's like current. That's going to be released in pretty much soon. So you can kind of just go a couple years from that. It's going to be higher resolution. It's going to probably be a much wider field of view if you want it, and it's probably going to be 3D in some way, shape, or form.
So that would be my – when I look at AR, specifically Google Glasses, one of the big features to me is that that they're not trying to do a true one-to-one overlay of reality. They're just giving you additional information. It's very much – it's more similar to a GUI in a video game or a HUD in a video game as opposed to being a – fighter pilot who has a triangle over their enemy airplane. Do you foresee us getting to a point where we have that sort of one-to-one overlay with reality where you would need that tracking or at least that level of comprehension of what the viewer is actually looking at?
I feel like you will, but only for very specific applications because where we're also seeing a, you know, wide swath of, you know, technology kind of maturing in this field, we're also seeing a lot of different use cases that are appearing in this field. And for every single use case, you're going to want different types of user interfaces and different types of overlays, and all of those use cases are going to have different types of requirements for how good the tracking needs to be, how good the augmented reality needs to be. Whether or not you need overlays or not, or just, you know, simple augmented text on whatever.
Wow. So what would be an example of a use case or the spectrum of use cases you're talking about or Ben?
One that always springs to mind for me immediately when I think of this stuff, and I think this is a weird one because there's a million, but I don't know why this one pops to my mind, auto mechanics. I can easily foresee a world where you've got auto mechanics wearing some form of Google Glass or some, you know, distant future ancestor of Google Glass, and they're up under your car and they're looking at things, and, you know, the glass knows, like, oh, because of the, you know, because of the telemetry that I'm receiving from the car itself right now, I know that this is a, you know, 2018 Honda Civic, and now I've loaded the 2018 Honda Civic specs, and okay, this is, blink, you know, it would highlight, this is the exhaust manifold, blink, here's where, you know, the fuel injectors are, and it's like, oh, fuel injectors are, you know, 0.6 millimeters out of alignment of what they should be. This needs adjustment. Highlight red versus green versus things that are in the wrong place.
So I feel like that's a fairly common, whenever you see a, God, what's the term? Speculative fiction being fiction that's looking at the far, at the near future, specifically usually in service of it becoming an application. So like Microsoft will release like speculative fiction videos. You know, where like it shows like an Indian student and Chinese student communicating instantly with a piece of smart glass.
Sure.
Because that's what they're about.
I hate those videos, by the way.
I do too. but specifically the use case that Ben just raised. Bae, how do you feel about that use case? Like, does that seem like a feasible use case?
I think that seems like a feasible use case 100%. Now, if you look at, you know, what we're talking about in terms of Google Glass, Google Glass specifically is, you know, a small overlay right above your field of vision.
Mm-hmm.
What you guys are talking about is an overlay directly over your field of vision.
Correct.
So you're going to have to have much better tracking as well as just even much better display.
Sure.
But that's coming. Rest assured, that is definitely coming.
Really?
Yes.
How soon will I get my mechanics classes? 5 years?
Ah, you're asking me to make a prediction here now.
That's what futurism is about.
Go on, make an ass of yourself. It's only going to be a couple years.
Maybe the codec will change. Maybe we won't be able to listen to this.
It'll be lost forever.
That's true. I'd say about 8 years.
8 years.
Ooh, I like that. That's not a number that you hear much when people make predictions. It's usually like 5, 7, 10, 3.
I'd argue most people reduce down to 7 because 7's like a really friendly number for humans. Yeah. Yeah.
It's not quite 10, a little more than 5, far enough away that you're like, ooh, people are like, what are you going to do in 5 years? You're like, well, I think it was 7. You're like, I don't fucking know. Be dead? I'm not sure.
So speaking of AR mechanics, one awesome application, current application I saw was, have you guys seen the HDR welding mask?
No.
No.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, well, so explain more,
I think I know what that is already just from the title. But
which is a great idea, right?
Yeah.
And specifically by, I was just talking about this the other day. It's by one of the guys who.
Hold on. You're making me explain Google Glass, which is one of the most like talked about tech things, and you're just going to throw HDR out there without freaking explaining it?
We'll get around. We'll get back to it. One second. I'm setting it up, dude.
Okay,
all right. So one of the gentlemen who wore a proto Google Glass for like 10 or 20 years, there's specifically one dude who's been in the media a lot, and I think he's been the most vocal about his butt hurt for not having Google Glass like contact him. He's like, I've been doing like the AR thing for the last like 20 years. Like, why didn't they ask me like how it was going?
So he knew you'd react like this.
Yes, exactly. So he's been a real bitch about it. Sorry, dude, if you're listening. And one of the examples they always use in the articles about him is specifically HDR welding masks. So when we talk about HDR, Bae, you're a display expert. So really, can you give us like a layman's term explanation of HDR?
No. I can give you a professional explanation.
What the hell does it even stand for?
Sure. It stands for high dynamic range.
Okay. And what does that mean to a person who doesn't do a lot of photography?
Sure. I'm going to use photography to explain this.
That's fine. Just explain it to somebody who's not a professional photographer.
I'll dumb it down for all of us after Bae explains it.
So if you look at a photograph, there's kind of like the white and the black part, right? And if you kind of scan that photograph in or you do some kind of chemical process in the old school photography, you can only get so much detail out of that white because it's been blown out because you're a shitty photographer and you've overexposed it. And you can also only get so much out of the black. Because you've underexposed it or whatever. But high dynamic range means exactly that. So what you've now done is stored things that are actually beyond white and things that are beyond black. So when you put photographic processes or you kind of decrease the brightness in Photoshop or whatever, you actually get those details back that were too blown out in the white or too black in the blacks.
Okay, so for layman's terms, you have super color eyes that let you see beyond blacks and whites.
I don't know if that
magic
is that might not
I'm
be
go with magic music. Vision.
I'm gonna throw my third one, guys. Sure. Secondary contest, vote on that was Bae's explanation. Then you got Ben's explanation. Now you get Logan's explanation. Vote, and the winner will receive a carving of a rocket ship out of cheese, and the cheese will be mailed to a random address we come up with.
You'll have to find it. It'll be an ARG that will run.
Yes, it'll be the
to
future.
Find the cheese
to the fucking future ARG. Starts now with cheese.
It's the worst ARG ever.
And, cheese ARG.
And
that's part of the ARG.
And it ends with rotten cheese.
For somebody.
For somebody.
Unless, some random person.
Alaska. Unless the cheese is really, really fancy Parmesan that like is 10-year aged and hard as a rock.
I don't know a lot about Parmesan. You know, if we run out of stuff to talk about with Bay, he's also really into cooking, so that was actually initially what I was going to interview him about, but then Bay's like, I'm actually a professional display expert, and I was like, right.
So, hold on. Hold the fucking phone.
I can talk about the future of food, too.
Okay, well, maybe we'll get around to that, or maybe you'll have to be a return guest.
All sorts of bullshitting.
But here's my attempt at explaining HDR. When you
bullshit.
Are in a dark room and you run outside, you'll notice that everything seems like blindingly bright, and then your eyes adjust and suddenly you can see outdoors, and then when you walk back indoors, suddenly everything's dark until your eyes adjust. So imagine if your eyes didn't adjust and could just see that entire spectrum from the darkest of darks and to the brightest of daylights, and you could capture all that information. And you actually see a lot in video games. Video games also use HDR when they render, and so that's why video games, even if they have really great textures and geometry, often don't quite look like reality. And vice versa, if you've ever seen HDR video, which somebody did with a beam splitter. Again, that's maybe something Bay should explain, not me. but more or less, it takes a single image and sends it into two different video feeds, and they change the exposure and combine them into an HDR video feed. It suddenly looks like a video game. If you ever see HDR photography, it often looks like a watercolor because it seems more real than real. Anyways, that's what HDR is, or at least that's our three different attempts at explaining the same concept. So there, go ahead, Ben. Do you have an issue?
I just like my description of people having magic eyes better. I think it's succinct.
You know about mantis shrimps?
I was thinking about this the whole time that they were having this discussion. It's like, yes, that's exactly what I was thinking about the whole time.
I actually also was thinking about mantis shrimps. Thanks, Oatmeal. Thank you, Oatmeal. So anyways, the HDR welding mask.
Really, we're just going to drop the mantis shrimp? You're not going to explain why we're all thinking of the mantis shrimp?
Despite that being a great article, I think the Oatmeal is kind of blur, and I don't think I really want to support them on this podcast. Okay, sorry if anybody's listening who really likes Oatmeal, and that was a great article if you're the person who wrote it. this is the price of bad-mouthing people on recorded mediums on the internet, is you have to throw out all these qualifiers. Anyway, so HDR welding mask. Specifically is an HDR view, stereoscopic view welding mask. The problem is when you're welding, obviously, usually you wear this incredibly dark piece of glass. I don't know what ND stands for, non-daylight?
Neutral filter? Density.
Neutral density, thank you. Neutral density filter. And so, you know, it's like a 2 or 3-stop ND, so that everything becomes insanely dark, so you can actually look at this insanely bright white supernova when you're welding. The problem is, obviously, you can't see anything that isn't where you're welding. Like, you can't even see right next to the weld where you might have tools or something of that nature. So what this allows you to do is look directly at that weld, see the weld, but also see everything around the weld. So it's an incredibly around the weld. Yeah, Ben, what's up?
So what you're telling me is that with this magical HDR welding goggle setup, I could have, as you described earlier, basically the HDR video feed.
Yeah.
But in my eyes, consuming my entire field of vision?
You know, considering he's using off-the-shelf cameras, I have to assume that the field of vision is pretty tight. But if you're welding, that isn't that rough.
Theoretically, you could build this headset to completely encompass my vision with this glorious, like, Technicolor shitstorm, right?
Sure. Yeah. But in the future.
Okay. But it sounds like I could do it right now if I had enough money and time blow on it.
Here's the thing with AR is there are two types, and I think Bay can probably elaborate on this. When I think of AR, there's two types of AR. There's the Google Glass AR where you're looking at reality and the overlay is a separate piece, and that's the only part that's media. But if you've ever seen a AR display where it's actually they take a video camera and then they feed the video camera to a screen that's overlaying your eye, that's rough because the resolution of that camera, right?
Sure.
As well as the inevitable delay, even if it's a tiny delay, is really vicious. And I don't think I've ever directly experienced the head-mounted AR display. Have you, Bay?
Yes.
How is it?
Sickness, puke-inducing.
There you go.
But that's fine because you get used to it.
Right.
Oh, there you go.
You then
there
you go.
Anything.
You get used to it. It'll be fine.
More than anything, I was curious about that because I would just the way you guys were describing it. I think I've even seen the AR or the HDR video demonstration before with like the color palette. But can you just imagine how fabulous it would be to put on that headset and then just like gobble down a fistful of shrooms and just like wait for that double kick right there? It's like everything's already beautiful. Everything's already shockingly beautiful. You're like any minute now, and then you're seeing like colors that people don't even have names for.
Yeah, that'd be great, I think. But you know, there's one bit of accuracy that I want to touch on, which is the way that you described HDR and the way that you guys are thinking about HDR right now are actually tone mapped HDR images. So what that is doing is actually taking the HDR and actually compressing it
into our visible,
or rather the way that we perceive images.
Gotcha.
Which is why you see those like kind of glowy, effervescent type of images.
So it's also, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't that also how we add color to like the deep space Hubble photography
yes,
of like the
very
various
similar.
Nebulas?
Yes, yes, very similar.
They don't look beautiful and gloriously colored.
So it's actually a fake image when you guys are talking about HDR, but the real concept of HDR is actually just capturing that entire much wider brightness and darkness.
Alex, can we delete the part where Logan and I sound like morons for 20 minutes?
I prefer to keep in the moron thing, but maybe put in a moron alert.
Oh,
so
yeah,
now,
some sort of like klaxon siren.
Yeah, so really quickly, Alex, you're going to please put in a moron alert when we talk, and then people will be like, what was that moron alert? And then they'll hear this part and be like, right, that makes total sense now. So we've been largely talking about augmented reality, which I would distinguish from virtual reality.
Really? You're going to make me talk about virtual reality?
Yeah, Betak, tell us a little bit about virtual reality.
I don't understand why you don't talk about virtual reality, considering you worked in a virtual reality lab for, 2 years, and then did an internship with a department that did virtual reality.
Maybe it's because I'm not the subject domain expert today.
Oh, okay.
So tell us about virtual reality, Bay.
Just the future or now?
Tell us first what the fuck virtual reality is.
Virtual reality was this really awesome concept that was, you know, made popular by science fiction such as Star Trek. So you have kind of the holodeck, and it's which you can have a display that is so real that it's indistinguishable from reality.
And how's this different from augmented reality? Just to spell it out.
Augmented reality is when you are either looking through a piece of glass or looking through a camera feed with an overlay on top of the glass in which you have the real world overlaid with virtual objects. Virtual reality is where everything is virtual.
So how do you feel about virtual reality?
It's the wave of the future. It's definitely going to be – no. It's virtual reality has its uses and also has its downfalls. Virtual reality needs kind of a lot of things to make it useful and usable for the general consumer. I'm sure many of you guys are familiar with the Oculus Rift. Do I need to explain what the Oculus Rift is?
Probably for the sake of our listeners, it wouldn't hurt.
Give it like the one-liner.
Yeah.
Sure. The Oculus Rift is a head-mounted display. So it is a display with some specialized optics.
Magic hat.
That you strap onto your face. And you get a completely virtual world rendered in that display. Oculus Rift is just the company's name that's making this particular display. And it was this Kickstarter thing that got super popular. And now everybody's very gung-ho about it. Anyways, that's kind of bringing virtual reality back into the forefront. It was also really kind of big in the early 90s in which kind of everybody was like, oh, man, virtual reality is the future of entertainment. You know, everybody's going to have like one of these virtual reality things. And then kind of, you know, you get into this really awesome, it's the uncanny valley, right? There's kind of the hype curve, right? Mm-hmm. And then you get into the valley of disillusionment. And man, the valley of disillusionment for virtual reality was very, very low. And basically everybody stopped using it with the exception of the military. So the military uses virtual reality to do flight simulator trainings, as well as soldier trainings, as well as drone trainings, as well as sniper training.
I'm actually in a virtual reality simulator in Fallout 3 right now.
There you go.
Really?
Yeah, in the Game of the Year edition, I'm playing the Fall of Anchorage as a soldier in the past.
That's cool.
In a virtual reality simulator tub.
Okay.
So really quickly, it wasn't just – I'll give you a little pushback. It didn't seem like it was just the military from my virtual reality days. It also seemed car designers continued to use it to some extent, or industrial designers also seemed to be a big clientele for virtual reality displays.
Yes,
that's
true. Okay, let me reverse that by saying the people that are using virtual reality are people with a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And when you say car designers, you don't mean just any car designers. You mean like
BMW,
really freaking famous car designers,
gigantic corporations with vast resources.
That's right. Because a lot of these virtual reality technologies right now, since nobody's doing them anymore, are very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And because they're very expensive, only the largest corporations can afford them.
So there's a lot of different branches I want to explore here. But specifically, let's start with maybe the juiciest one. Do you foresee the Oculus Rift being successful?
I hope the Oculus Rift is successful. I don't think this particular embodiment, or rather this implementation of the Oculus Rift, is going to be successful. Maybe their Generation 2 and maybe their Generation 3 will be. But this current one doesn't quite cross the threshold for me.
Why not?
Well, let's start with some of the technical reasons. So when I say that you want to be indistinguishable from reality, that's actually this guy named Ivan Sutherland. He invented things like computer graphics.
Buh, big fucking deal.
Anyways, he had this quote where he's like, the ultimate display. What is the ultimate display? And it's like, an ultimate display is indistinguishable from reality such that a bullet would be fatal. And if you actually died in that world, you would die in real life. So that's
sounds
kind of
perfect.
That's the ultimate display. So everybody that's been kind of trying to strive for that is kind of making the penultimate display, right? In which you kind of turn the security feature off, you know, the safety, so to speak, on Star Trek when they're like, holodeck, turn the safety
off. Yeah, Moriarty walks out and everything goes to shit.
Wait, why would they ever turn the safety off? What, like, who's
because
doing that?
Because they need a plot this week.
I don't know.
Usually it's Moriarty, at least in TNG.
I think they did, like, training or something like that. What was I saying before I talked about Star Trek?
I'll tell you.
Oh, yeah, the Oculus Rift.
The reason the safety gets turned off is because someone is in there doing some freaky sex game stuff, and they want to be sure that they're really getting choked. They turn it off, and they forget to reset it after they leave. The next thing you know, the damn thing is self-aware and is in some sort of fucking riddle game with Picard over who gets to run the goddamn Enterprise.
So specifically, autoerotic asphyxiation is the only reason for a humongous feature that ultimately endangers entire crews of spaceships.
I also like how the options isn't saved with the user and is saved with the actual holodeck itself.
Obviously.
As if, like, in the future, there are no user interface designers for this.
I would like to point out, Logan, that yes, while technically it's autoerotic asphyxiation for the participant, Riker, it is not. He is being choked by a participant.
So if you guys are interested in autoerotic asphyxiation, I don't know where to reference, like where to send you. But if you're interested in the holodeck and interfaces of the future, I'm going to go ahead and plug a book that I have nothing to do with, but I just read, called Make It So.
I'm unfamiliar.
Make It So is, I guess, some user interface designers in San Francisco going and analyzing different sci-fi movies, starting with, like, Millier's, like, Trip to the Moon.
Nice.
Right? And, like, working their way through Metropolis from, like, the 1920s all the way through Star Trek Next Generation. And the newest movie, I think they're doing Fifth Element on their website right now. And before that, they did Prometheus. But they just go through, and as user interface designers, go ahead and, like, break these down. Like, okay, like... Like, he's using these joysticks. I don't know if that actually works for X, Y, and Z reasons. But what was the most interesting thing about it, they do a whole section on the holodeck, and they actually do a whole section on sex in the holodeck. Or, sorry, sex interfaces. They have, like, a whole chapter devoted to sex interfaces. But
Teledildonics, by the way.
Yes.
One of my favorite
is the technical term.
It's a great word, yeah. So they do a deep dive into teledildonics. But, yeah, check it out. Great book. Highly recommend it. We'll leave it at that.
We'll have a whole episode on teledildonics in a few
weeks.
Yeah,
we will. Well, if we can find the right guest.
I think that we, you know what? Devilman knows a bunch of porn actresses.
But we don't want a porn actress. I want
you
some...
don't want a porn actress because you have a girlfriend.
I actually do know somebody that is interested in teledildonics.
Like
that
a real
has a robotics background.
Let's get them and some porn actresses.
I just love the idea of it's like we stop inviting experts and just start inviting aficionados. We went to the local adult bookstore and explained teledildonics to the closest three people. Oculus Rift.
Oculus Rift. Its field of view, while is probably the largest on the market, is still not quite enough. Also, its resolution, while it's one of the largest on the market, is still quite not enough. So we all talk about the retinal display, right?
If I may interrupt,
the iPad.
Quite not enough or not quite enough, i.e. it's way far away from what it needs to be or it's almost there?
It's almost there.
Okay.
It's almost there. Everybody has kind of heard of the iPad and how it's got this like super dense display that is kind of, they're calling the retinal display because it is literally at what's called eye-limiting resolution even when you hold it close to your face. And that's true. So we are at eye-limiting resolution for that particular display. But when you strap it to your head and put optics on it, you're actually expanding those pixels out. And when you expand those pixels are actually quite large. So that's kind of like looking essentially at your CRT television, right? Your old, not HD television, that's essentially what you are getting with the current Oculus Rift.
But if you were sitting like 5 to 10 inches away from it.
Yes, exactly.
So basically if you're like 4 or 5 on a Saturday morning.
That's right.
So maybe there's like a nostalgia market here to explore.
Yeah. I don't know about that. And then also the second thing is in terms of the rendering as well as the tracking. So the tracking, it's got its kind of own inertial tracker in it.
What are we talking about when we say tracking? For people who aren't...
It is able to track your head's rotation so that when it renders the world, it can render it with a counter rotation. So it seems like you're just looking around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that tracker is not fast enough yet.
Do you think we only... So when we talk about tracking, for those people who don't talk about tracking a lot, we talk about position and orientation. So your movement through space and then specifically the rotation of your head. So looking up, down, left, and right. Do you think we only need orientation to make this work?
No. I think you 100% need translation. And here's where the real kicker is of why virtual reality is not that great yet, is because there's no good way to move around a large space, which, by the way, is one of the beauties of virtual reality, is that you are now in a world. Except for now you're in a world and you can only move in a 5x5 square. And that's not very fun.
Right.
So right now there's not really that many technologies out there that aren't exorbitantly expensive in which you can kind of stay in one position and feel like you're moving through a much larger space.
Right. And even still with those technologies, say, I would assume a fighter jet simulator that the military uses per se.
And that's much better because you're in a vehicle.
Right. Yes. And so, but like, I have a hard time figuring out, just trying to think wild sky, what exists that could put you in a holodeck-sized room and convince you that you can go hiking up a mountain and have miles and miles to roam.
They're actually, so...
Ooh, shut my mouth right now, please. Tell me there's something cool out there.
Well, it's a very real line of study. In fact, before I knew Bay, that was kind of our lab's deal, or at least it's especially their deal now. And the lab is actually, they're kind of like the guys who built the Oculus Rift or helped the kid make the Oculus Rift. But there's, is it misdirected walking?
Yes.
Is that the term?
Yes.
So there's misdirected walking, which we'll circle back around. And then I think a lot of people talk about two-dimensional treadmills. Is that a
omnidirectional term? Treadmills.
Omnidirectional. Mm-hmm. So the idea that it's a treadmill that you can walk left, right, up, and down.
Does that work if I'm – I mean, I'm sure that there's a certain amount of fooling that you can do to the brain using imagery and whatnot to convince me that my omnidirectional treadmill isn't just me walking through a nice flat meadow. But
right, omnidirectional treadmills, amazing for really flat surfaces.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Like, it's like if I
do
see
they actually
a
work? Do they work? I thought there was like a momentum issue.
Those have actually mostly been solved.
So the main issue is just texture beyond flat planes.
Right.
Well, and then you got to take it further. It's like, is it snowing? Where's the wind coming from? What's the humidity in the air? There's like a million things that are going on with your like non-visual nervous system that I would assume you talk about, the reaction times.
That's
on
right.
your perception as you turn your head. God help you, reaction times on a bunch of actual – either you need to plug into someone's nervous system and start to learn how to spoof physical sensations on the skin, or you got to figure out how to turn an air conditioner and an omnidirectional fans
well,
and everything.
I think the future is actually is plugging into
spoofing.
Your nervous system.
And that was a question I was going to ask was, do you think that at the current rate of display technology and the advancement that's going through versus the current, and this might not be your realm of expertise, but the rate at which we're learning how to interface directly with the brain, with computers and spoof sensations and things with you know, magnetic fields and whatnot. I've read some interesting studies about creating weird sensations using MRIs, essentially just to like screw with your brain.
My dad is an MRI researcher.
There you go. There's actually
deeping that problem.
there's a whole fascinating.
Father, son, tag team.
Family science porn.
But, first kid to draw that and tweet it to us gets another cheese.
We got to work on
you're
this.
You're not giving them the cheese. You're shipping it to someone else.
This cheese for you. This cheese goes to you.
Yeah, but I'm going to carve it into a shape of my own choosing, and I guarantee it will not be a mammal.
Mantis shrimp
in full color. But yeah, do you think that, you know, is there all of this wonderful technology that they're working on with displays will ultimately be rendered moot and pointless? Because if you're going to get to a point where you can spoof a nervous system convincingly enough to make me feel like I'm in a snowstorm and then I walk out of the snowstorm into my warm, toasty cabin that smells like a steak grilling on, you know, the grill, are we just going to blow past all of that and all this display technology and just be like, yeah, we're just going to dump the images right in your brain. You're going to lay there and you're going to see it.
I don't think so. I do think much of it will be useless. Mm-hmm. However, what we're talking about here is not just fancy rendering, you know, the things that we're talking about with computer graphics now. What we're talking about is just general computing.
Mm-hmm.
The field of video games, the field of computer graphics, the field of networking, of, you know, all of the companies pulling resources in, I see it as just developing compute and developing how we can harness compute. And if you really kind of look at, you know, Moore's Law, I mean, Moore's Law is just at the cusp of really taking off.
Right.
You know, we talk about, and this is where I really kind of have hope for the future in terms of data and compute. And this is why I also think, you know, much of my point earlier about like all of this format stuff, I don't think we actually have to worry about that because computers will be so fast at some point and can compute so much. You can just throw a data and be like, make sense of it.
Yeah, it won't be like, do we have the codec for this? The computer will be like, whatever, here it is. Shut up,
meatbag. Yeah, exactly. It's like, here's this codec I just made for you for this thing. I mean, if you think about it now.
I imagine future computers will say that a lot to us.
Yeah.
Duh.
Because they will be much smaller. Because they will be much smarter. Within our lifetime, we will have a computer that is probably going to be more powerful than your brain. Think about that.
There's actually a fascinating thing today. Brand new little piece of news. Literally the day of this recording that was announced by Stanford, I believe, they figured out, a research team figured out how to physically strip away the lipid layer out of biological constructs such as your brain, which allows them then to fully, in three dimensions, create an image of a brain's neuronal connections without essentially thinly slicing it. And so by stripping out the lipid layer, they can basically just like use some sort of light microscope. I don't know, science, biology. I don't know shit about biology. And the video that they were showing of this was basically a three-dimensional image of a brain that was like a literal brain that wasn't a computer reconstruction of thin little slices.
That's right.
And they say it will revolutionize neurology and the study of the human brain because we can see it how it is supposed to look.
And computational neurology. I mean, computational neurology is fascinating, right? You can actually, using neural networks – do I have to explain neural networks?
Yes.
Oh my gosh, this is going to be tough. Neural networks is a way of programming things in the computer to literally simulate what neurons do in a brain. The most simple neural networks can actually demonstrate mild creativity. So in other words, you can train a neural network to actually recognize pieces of music, and then you can actually turn that around and have the neural network generate music.
Unsettling.
But through kind of the study of neural networks, you can, on today's computers, you can actually simulate a full rat brain. Like the
just
actual
– Just do it, yeah.
The actual
Is it ethically wrong to delete that program once you've had it running?
Well, let me ask you that – let me ask you another question. In a couple of years, and I actually mean within our lifetime, probably in the 40 or 50 years, you will be able to simulate the entire human brain that way. Is it ethical to delete that?
Is it me?
Yeah, there's a button. There's a button on front
it's
of you.
The me simulator.
Yes, there's a button on front of you. It's blinking red, and it is you
in
having
that box.
Having experienced 4 years of a life.
Right. Okay. So two things spring immediately to mind outside of your ethics question. One, finally everyone will get a chance to understand just how obnoxious they are. And imagine the vast existential crisis that all of comfortable, like, well-fed society will have when they sit there and talk to themselves, a simulation of themselves on a neural networking computer, and be like, holy shit, I am a drunk asshole.
It would be
people
right.
hang out with me and I talk like this.
It would be something like that. It would actually be a little bit like time traveling, right? Because because what makes us very
or having sex with your own clone.
Ooh, wow. I think if you read The Time Traveler's Wife, I think there's actually a part
absolutely.
Of him where he has sex with himself.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, for real.
I think so. So you basically you simulate a neural network and you load it into your clone and then you fuck yourself.
There you go. But no, what I was going to say with what actually makes us very complicated and perhaps the kind of only wrinkle in being able to simulate a complete human being is the fact that we have experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And our experiences is quite literally what shapes our brain
sure.
and our mind. And you will
– So that simulated
– You will have to do that. It takes time to do that.
Right. I mean, unless you could theoretically take it with all this compute that is being built right now –
accelerate that.
You could – well, or for instance, if you could take a perfect neuronal snapshot, let's say, of the state of my brain down to, you know, an atomic or whatever is necessary level to accurately simulate the disposition of my memories and experience in my, you know, wetware or whatever you want to call it, and then you run that simulation on a computer, then that neural network
will
simulation
literally be
is
you.
Me. It yes. is literally me.
Yes.
And so then I really will know how obnoxious I am.
Yep.
Right up to that exact point.
That's right. And you can also hit delete.
Yeah, and also hit delete. Which, I mean, I guess, you know, that'll be an interesting – well, you know what? Maybe the real test would be if the neural network also had the illusion of hitting a delete button on me. And we had a like, and ready, set, go. And then does my behavior and does the behavior of the simulated neural network deviate enough from one another to seem like it's more than just a mirror image? If we're simulating for the simulated neural network exactly what I'm experiencing it, or we're fooling the fake me or the computer me
sure.
into feeling that it is the real me, not a computer simulation, if it deviates from exactly what I'm doing, does that imply it's on its own now? It's not me anymore.
Probably.
Well,
so
it's,
there
it's,
you go.
Well, that's
or
the
is
thing.
It just it, sitting it, there hitting the button going, this is creepy. God, I'm obnoxious. Like, and I'm doing the same thing. Like, God, this is creepy.
What's
God,
interesting is you guys both went for, will it be okay to delete the artificial intelligence, for lack of a better term, at that point?
If it truly is.
If it truly is. I'd actually go the other way, which is at that point, like, do we get totally comfortable with just deleting humans? Like, are we just cool with, like, dude, this is just another program. Just kill, like, off that bro. Just off some bros.
How dark are we going to get here? Because we can get pretty dark
super
here.
Fucking dark.
But real get, quick. Get so dark. Now, dude,
I can get mega dark.
We'll change your last name if you want so you can get extra dark. Bay Rang.
You know, a growing trend right now is the growth in population, right? And this is an exponential growth curve. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that human population growth in this world is probably one of the largest problems that we will have to face because it leads to every other problem.
Sure. Totally agree.
Like pollution, global warming, whatever. They're actually
caused. There's too many of us.
Right. This is just caused by a lot of people. And, you know, we have this really kind of attitude as we're growing up in which it's like, oh, man, human life. It's
precious.
Priceless. It's
although I would argue that is an artifact of the culture and relatively comfortable society that we three grew up in.
Yeah.
There's a lot of societies that are like, fuck human life. If it's not mine or my wife, fuck them.
Basically Appalachian people is what you're describing.
Well, that's dark, but I was going to go. I mean, yeah, probably to a certain extent, but I would also say anywhere where there is a constant daily struggle to keep your belly full, your level of empathy is probably towards another random human being that you have no connection to.
That's right.
Is a lot more flexible. Think Stalingrad in the winter of 42.
And that's precisely my point. With more people, life will be worth less.
I will say, though, that
and with artificial people, life will be worth even less because now you can build them like the best of them.
Fair enough. I will say, though, that the growth trend actually is has been continuously revised downward over the last 20 or 30 years. And one of the most recent pieces of work on human population growth right now that literally, again, came out 3 or 4 days ago. It was a really a kind of one-of-a-kind, kind of groundbreaking meta-analysis of population projections since the UN started doing them in the 50s all the way to about 2 years ago. And they kind of did this huge meta-analysis of population projections in the 50s all the way up to and how things met. And, the, you know, they when they do those projections, they do, you know, lowest growth rate, medium growth rate, you know, kind of assumed growth rate, worst case scenario based on all these different inputs. And it's changed over many, many decades. And the most recent UN one they did in 2011 kind of presumed that we would hit, I want to say, like 10 billion people by like 2070 or 2080, and then we would begin to decline, which is actually a huge revision for a lot less people.
Why would we decline?
Because that is literally – because the birth rate worldwide is going down. In many – in almost every single industrialized country,
that's true.
The birth rate is below replacement. All of Western Europe, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, North America, almost entirely. And like we're not talking like maintenance. We're talking below replacement level. That we are all of Western Europe. And then on top of that, nations that in the 70s had like unbelievable birth rates. Like quite – so the way that they measure birth – or they categorize birth rate is you have number of children – per one woman, essentially, is kind of how they categorize it, because the idea is that one woman and one man have to come together to create a baby. And so you can say like one child to one woman implies that there were two that created one. And so that would be a below replacement level. Two to one is a flat growth, or not growth, but it's flat. You maintain your population, and anything above two is growth, obviously. And so in countries like Mexico and Iran, the birth rates in the 70s and 80s were literally like 8 to 13 children for every woman. So they were ridiculously high. And I pick Iran and Mexico specifically because they are countries that, you know, Mexico is extremely culturally conservative and very, very, very Catholic, as we all know has some issues with birth control. Mm-hmm. And Iran, for a completely different set of cultural reasons, is extremely conservative and has very negative attitudes, at least officially, towards birth control. What we have seen in both of those societies, who are also arguably not as modern or as comfortable as Western Europe or the United States, is that since the 80s and the 70s, their birth rates have absolutely collapsed as well. Where like Mexico is like just barely above replacement level. They're like 2.2 children per woman right now. And Iran is in a similar space. And China, though, you know, as brutal and as awful as it was, the one child policy was shockingly successful. And they are now facing a whole other gigantic demographic challenge 20 to 30 years from now, because they're going to experience what we're starting to experience right now with the baby boomers. We have too many old people and not enough young people to support them. They're going to experience that by a factor of like 100 to what we're experiencing right now.
So why do you think that is? What's your hypothesis? If you had to give one hypothesis, each of you.
I don't have to give a hypothesis. There's already research data.
Yeah, this is pretty solid research data.
Yeah, just the higher you get in terms of socioeconomic status, you have less children.
Why?
Yeah. Because the two factors they guess at, and there's one that drives another. As infant mortality goes down, you don't have to have as many babies effectively for security purposes. Even in a poorer agricultural society, if your infant mortality is really low, you don't have to have eight children knowing that four or five of them are going to make it to birth, and you don't know which four, or to birth, excuse me, to adulthood to take care of you. Mm-hmm. And keep working the land or whatever else. So if your infant mortality goes way down, that helps a lot. And then the other big correlative one that could be causative is an educated female populace. So the more educated women are in your society, the more agency typically they will have in the legal and, you know, economic sphere. And they will, you know, of course, take full legal and biological control of their bodies. And so that, you know, they're no longer they're not just being forced to be baby machines, essentially. And as those things happen kind of worldwide, as they have been slowly but steadily, those birth trends go down.
However, that's still a crap ton of people.
Yeah, it's still a shit ton of people. But the thing about this whole meta-analysis that before we got way off on this was that basically this huge meta-analysis that a technical university in Spain did was essentially saying like, yeah, so the really low-end estimate, the super low-end estimate from the UN's most recent study, which says that we will top out in 2050 and actually there will be fewer people on Earth in 2100 than there are today. according to their meta-analysis, is the most accurate and most likely. That their estimate is there'll be about 6.5 billion people on the planet in 2100 based on natural growth rate that is stalling out.
So by 2200, will we get back to down to like Mesopotamia levels where it's like 1 billion dudes just chilling?
We'll probably find a new equilibrium that will be a lot lower.
I don't know how we got to – oh, you were talking about displays not mattering as much in the long term.
That's true.
So give us your – I don't want to go too long term. Let's go with the what year do you think you'll die, Bay? What'd you say? You had to give yourself a year.
Throw that singularitarian dice down on the table, Bay.
No, this is kind of a loaded question because as long as we're on a futures show, I might as well talk about the future of life expectancy.
Yeah. Sure.
Right? I don't think I'm going to live forever, but I think I will live quite long. Mainly because...
Up top,
right?
I'll see you in 150 years, Bay.
Mainly because of what's happening in terms of medicine, right? And it's not about how fast, you know, it's not about life expectancy getting greater, but it's actually about the rate in which life expectancy is getting greater.
Sort of like a biological escape velocity.
That's right. So as long as your life expectancy is increasing, right? If it increases at a rate of faster of 1 year per every 1 year, you can think that people will live forever.
Are we getting there? Are we at that rate?
No. There's actually a lot of research data to say that that's kind of plateauing out. But
actually, if I recall correctly, maximum human lifespan hasn't appreciably increased. Most of the big gains in life expectancy were actually a statistical fluke based on, again, infant mortality rates. Going
that's
way
right.
down.
That's right.
Can we get like a can you say infant mortality rate? And then, Alex, can we get like a really sweet like womp, 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 womp?
All right. Let's do that. Alex, are you ready? Infant mortality rate.
Great. Okay. I really hope that really
like
knocked
how you
it
guys
out.
Said great simultaneously. Great. You were like two anime heroes.
So yeah. So
in terms of like how when am I gonna die? When am I gonna die? I would say like I don't know 2000. Let's say 2080.
Okay, 2080. Describe to me the displays of 2080.
2080, by that time, we will probably be either beaming stuff into your eyes quite literally. In other words...
Just hitting that optic nerve with a laser.
Just hitting that optic nerve with a laser, or we will have found a way to actually tap into your neural network.
So pretty much just a straight-up matrix situation.
Pretty much just a straight-up matrix situation, probably without that giant cable in the back of your head, which would probably kill you.
I should hope so, because that needle, if you just measure how a human skull is shaped, probably should have been sticking out of his mouth, right?
Yeah, something like that. So not that, but...
No head vagina.
Probably something close. Okay. Probably something close.
So two last questions before we sign off for this week.
You're totally just going to make these up right now.
No, yep. they're written. No. Two things. You guys have been definitely kind of, I'd say, tap dancing around the singularity, which isn't something we've actually talked about at length here.
You serious? You're going to bring this up in like the last 2 minutes?
I'm a little shocked that you would be so bold as to do that as well.
And we'll dive into the singularity when we find a guest who is Ray Kurzweil. But until then...
Well, what if we got Werner Vang and he just kind of sat there and was kind of standoffish? Or is he dead? He's dead, isn't he? Werner Vang, baby.
There's that guy who just got cancer. Maybe he'd come on the show.
There's a lot of guys who just got cancer.
No, specifically, there's his name's like Isaiah Thompson or Ian Thompson, and he's
I'm pretty sure he's a basketball player.
Well, okay, fair enough. There is a specific sci-fi author who is the person who actually came up with why I bring this up: the idea of uploading your consciousness to a computer.
I mean, Werner Vang is largely thought of as kind of the sci-fi father of singularity thinking.
So there's multiple definitions of singularity, though. Are you talking about the uploading your consciousness to the cloud, or are you talking about AI reaching sentience? Short answer.
Neither. He thinks it's more thought of as the natural endpoint of enlightenment thinking, and whether that means uploading your brain or AIs that can build their own forebears more quickly and better than we can. Sure, either one.
I feel like we really need to break that out because I didn't quite understand you. But anyways, there's this dude who has cancer.
Isaiah Thompson, the basketball player.
We'll figure out who it really is. You guys, tweet me and I'll look it up if you
bother
me about
it. Do people actually tweet you?
Somebody actually tweeted...
Do I owe someone a balsa wood carving of something?
No. Somebody tweeted me a poster of our UAV film, Bros Off the Court, which was the sequel to Top Gun. it was an incredible poster. Good job, dude. Yeah, now I'll forward it to you.
Okay.
So that was Bros Off the Court. That was a great, yeah. Anyways, I don't even remember why it was called that. I was probably too drunk. But do you think you'll, would,
A, do you think you'll have the opportunity to upload your consciousness to cloud? And B, would you?
Yeah, and yeah.
Yes and yes.
As a clarifying question?
So you will live forever. Wait, one or at least a copy of you will live forever.
That's what I wanted to ask. Do you think that you would actually be able to do copy, or are you going to pull some sort of sketchy ship of Theseus kind of thing where you swap out a hunk of your brain at a time with a little computer processor until you're just you?
Well, at that point, I mean, we get into this whole moral argument of like, what is you? But to answer your question bluntly, yes, I think I will reach a point in which our consciousness slash all of our memories slash all of whatever can be uploaded.
And do you think you, and just sorry to continue to nitpick, do you think you will experience a disruption, or will it just be a copy? Do you think it will be from your point of view, your bay right now point mm-hmm. of view, do you think that there will be an uninterrupted like, and now I'm here and I'm this thing? Or do you think you'll be sitting there blinking and then there'll be another bay going, well, now I'm here and I'm this thing, and it'll be like, shit, still gonna die?
Both.
Ooh, that's fucking weird.
That's cheating.
That is cheating.
What does that even mean, both?
It will be both.
Well, but this is just, we should have him back for the singularity chat. We can't get into this in the last minute.
We totally will be both. That's the definition.
You are hereby officially invited to our singularity chat with Ray Kurzweil. Good luck, everybody. All the producers are sitting out there. Get us Ray Kurzweil.
Yeah, you guys got to get Ray Kurzweil. Hey, Dez.
Dez is giving us thumbs up. Yeah, guys, next week, Ray Kurzweil.
He held up a sign that said Ray Kurzweil agreed to come.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Great. Okay, so awesome. And for our final sign off, babe.
I just tweeted Ray. We're going to find out in like 10 seconds, guys.
Yeah! Freddie is also officially invited.
Wait, does that mean we should just sit here and wait until we get a tweet back?
Guys, we'll announce on the next recording Ray Kurzweil's appearance on that recording.
Yeah, it'll be really obvious when he's sitting here.
Yeah, because he'll totally be here. Bae, what's your favorite virtual reality movie?
Please say Existence. Please say Existence. Please say Existence.
I actually haven't watched that many, but I will say one thing that's been ingrained in my mind, and it's hard to call it a favorite. I would much say
poignant.
Formative.
Okay.
Lawnmower Man.
Ooh.
And I will say Lawnmower Man because it scared the shit out of me.
Yeah, that fucked me up as a little kid too.
I was like, what the F is going on? Why is he in the computer? Why does he have six heads? Why is everything purple and gold? It's over.
That's a pretty good summary of the Lawnmower Man plot, actually.
And that's why Bae is in virtual reality, thanks to Lawnmower Man.
Exactly. Definitely that movie.
Well, Bae, thank you very much for joining us on To the Fucking Future.
Indeed.
Well, thank you very much, guys.
Thank you, Bae. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Logan. Thank you, Bae.
To the Fucking Future!